Brothers, don't be childish in thinking, however in malice be like infants, but mature in your thoughts. As you would expect, after his lengthy debate and demonstration, he adopts a more forceful style and plenty of rebuke. He also mentions an example relevant to the topic. For it's usual for children to be attracted to trivial things and to be easily excited, but they don't show as much admiration for genuinely important things. These people, having the gift of tongues, which was the least significant of all, believed they had everything. So, he says, don't be children, meaning don't lack understanding where you should be thoughtful, but be childlike and simple where there is wickedness, vanity, and pride. For the person that is naive in wickedness should also be wise. Because as wisdom with wickedness wouldn't be wisdom, so simplicity with foolishness wouldn't be simplicity. It's necessary to avoid foolishness even in simplicity, and wickedness even in wisdom. Just as neither bitter nor sweet medicines in excess do any good, so neither does simplicity by itself nor wisdom. This is why Christ instructed us to balance both when he said, "Be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves." But what does it mean to be naive in wickedness? It means not knowing what wickedness even is. Indeed, this is how he wanted them to be. That's also why he said, "It is actually being said that there is fornication among you." He didn't say, "is happening," but "being said." It's as though he said, "You are not ignorant of this. You've heard about it at some point." I'm saying he wanted them to be both adults and children, adults in wisdom, but children in wickedness. For by being childlike in wickedness, even a man can truly become a man. But if he is not childlike in wickedness, then he cannot truly be an adult, because the wicked, instead of being mature, will just be a fool. Verse 21. In the law it is written, "I will speak to this people through men of foreign languages and through the lips of foreigners, yet even then they will not listen to me," says the Lord. Indeed, nowhere is it written in the law, as I mentioned before. He always refers to the entirety of the Old Testament as the law, both the prophets and the historical books, and he cites his evidence from Isaiah the prophet, again subtly diminishing the grandeur of the gift for their benefit. However, even in this way, he presents it with praise. For the phrase, "not even this way," has the power to indicate that the miracle was enough to astound them. And if they did not believe, the blame was theirs. And why did God perform it if they were not to believe, so that he might always be seen as fulfilling his part? Having demonstrated then, even through prophecy, that the sign in question isn't of great importance, he continues, "Therefore, tongues are a sign not for believers, but for the unbelievers, whereas prophesying is a sign not for unbelievers, but for believers. Therefore, if the whole church gathers together and all speak in tongues and uneducated or unbelieving men walk in, wouldn't they say that you are crazy? But if everyone prophesies and an unbeliever or someone uninformed comes in, they are convicted by all, they are evaluated by all. And in this way the secrets of his heart are revealed, and he will then fall face first and worship God, affirming that God is indeed among you." There is a significant difficulty here, arising from what has been said. For if speaking in tongues is a sign for those who do not believe, how can it be said that if those who do not believe see you speaking in tongues, they will say that you are mad? And if prophecy is not for the unbelieving but for those who believe, how can the unbelievers benefit from it? For if one comes in, he says, while you are prophesying, one that does not believe, he is critiqued by all and judged. And not only this, but also after this, another question arises. It seems that speaking in tongues may appear superior to prophecy. For if the tongues are a sign for the unbelievers and prophecy for those who believe, that which attracts non-believers and makes them part of the family is greater than that which governs those within the family. So, what does that phrase mean? Nothing difficult or unclear, nor contrary to what was mentioned earlier, but rather very consistent with it, if we pay attention, that is, prophecy is fitting for both, but speaking in tongues not so. Therefore, after saying of the tongue, "it is a sign," he adds, "not to those who believe, but to the unbelievers," and to them, "as a sign," in other words, for amazement, not so much for instruction. But in the context of prophecy too, says someone, he did exactly the same, stating, "But prophesying is not for the unbelieving, but for those who believe. For the believer does not need to see a sign, but only requires teaching and questioning. So how then do you say," says he, "that prophecy is useful to both, when Paul states it's not for the unbelieving, but for those who believe?" If you analyze closely, you will understand what was said. For he didn't express, "Prophecy is not helpful for those not believing," but rather, "It's not a sign," similar to the tongue speaking, that is, merely being a sign without any benefit. Nor is the speaking tongue useful to believers at all, for its only purpose is to amaze and to confuse, the term sign being one of those that can be interpreted in two ways, just like when he states, "Show me a sign," and follows up with, "For good, and again I have become a wonder to many," or in other words, a sign. And to demonstrate that he used the word sign here, not as something that naturally did good, he included the resulting consequence. And what was this? "People will say," he asserts, "that you are mad." However, this is not because of the sign's nature, but due to their foolishness. But when you hear of unbelievers, do not assume they are always the same individuals. At times they are those who are hopelessly ill and remain uncorrected, and at other times they could be those who can change. These people admire the great deeds of God that they hear about during the apostles' times, just like Cornelius did. Hence, his point is that prophecy is useful among both the unbelievers and those who believe. In contrast, the tongue, when heard by the unbelieving and thoughtless, is mocked as madness instead of benefiting from it. Indeed, to them it is merely a sign meant only to astonish them, whereas those who had understanding could also benefit from it, for which the sign was given. Just as there were not only those who accused them of drunkenness then, but also many who admired them for narrating God's wonderful deeds. It seems then that the mockers were those without understanding. That's why Paul didn't just say, "People will say that you are mad," he also added, "unlearned and unbelievers." But prophecy isn't just for a sign. It's also appropriate and beneficial for faith and for profit to both groups. And this, if not immediately, he clarified further later on, stating, "He is criticized by all. For if everyone prophesies," he says, "and an unbelieving or uneducated person enters, he is criticized by all. He is judged by all. And in this way the secrets of his heart are revealed. And so he will fall on his face and worship God, affirming that God is truly among you." So not only is prophecy greater in its effectiveness with each group, but also in its ability to attract the more brazen unbelievers. For it wasn't the same amazement when Peter condemned Sapphira, which was an act of prophecy, and when he spoke in tongues, but in the former situation, everyone retreated into themselves, whereas when he spoke in tongues, he was even regarded as being out of his mind. Having thus stated that speaking in tongues does not bring any benefit, and having further refuted this statement by blaming the Jews, he suggests that it instead causes harm. Why was it given then? It was given to be expressed with interpretation, for without this, it produces the opposite effect among those who lack understanding. "For," he says, "if everyone speaks in tongues and non-believers or uneducated people enter, they will claim that you are insane." Indeed, even the apostles were suspected of being drunk. These men, it states, are filled with new wine. But it's not a flaw of the sign, but of their lack of skill. Thus he added, "unlearned and unbelievers," to indicate that this idea stems from their ignorance and lack of faith. As I previously stated, his aim is to categorize that gift not among things that are depreciated, but among those that don't yield substantial benefits. This is with the intention to humble them and necessitate the seeking of an interpreter. As the majority did not focus on this and instead used it for showing off and competition, he particularly discourages this, implying they damage their reputation by seeming insane. And this is predominantly what Paul frequently endeavors to prove when he wishes to steer people away from anything. He demonstrates that the individual suffers damage in respect to those very things they desire. And you should do the same. If you want to steer people away from pleasure, show them that the thing is bitter. If you want to discourage them from vanity, show them that it's full of dishonor. This is how Paul used to operate. When he wanted to detach the rich from their love of money, he didn't just say that wealth is harmful, but also that it leads to temptations. For those who desire to be rich, he says, fall into a temptation. In this way, he attributes the opposite qualities to riches than what the rich believed. Others clung on to worldly wisdom as if it established Christ's doctrine. He implies that it doesn't just not support the cross, but also makes it void. They believed in going to court before strangers, thinking it inappropriate to be judged by their own, as if outsiders were more knowledgeable. He highlights that going to court before outsiders is disgraceful. They stuck to things offered in sacrifice to idols, as a sign of complete knowledge. He suggests that this is a sign of incomplete knowledge, not knowing how to behave in matters concerning our neighbors. Similarly, because they were excessively enthusiastic about this gift of tongues through their love of glory, he suggests that this, more than anything, brings shame on them, not only stripping them of glory, but also suggesting a suspicion of madness. But he didn't state this up front, but after discussing many other things when his discourse was accepted, he introduces this topic that greatly contrasted their own views. In fact, this is just a general principle. If you intend to completely change a deeply ingrained belief and do a complete turnaround, you shouldn't instantly state the contrary. Otherwise, you will seem ridiculous to those who are predisposed to the contrary belief. As anything that's significantly unexpected cannot be easily accepted from the start, you must first carefully dismantle the issue with other arguments, then introduce the contrasting standpoint. For example, this was his approach when he was discussing marriage, specifically as many considered it a source of ease, and he wanted to suggest that refraining from marriage was, in fact, easier. If he had stated this directly, it would not have been as readily accepted. But now, after much discussion and choosing the right moment to bring it up, he effectively influenced the listeners. He did the same thing when discussing virginity. After extensive discussion before and after the topic, he eventually said, "I spare you," and "I want you to be free from worries." 1 Corinthians 8:28-32. This, then, he does with regard to languages, demonstrating that they not only strip away glory, but also bring shame to those who possess them in the eyes of the non-believers. Whereas prophecy, conversely, is both free from disgrace among non-believers and holds a high degree of credibility and usefulness. No one will refer to those who prophesy as being insane, nor will anyone ridicule them. Rather, they will be amazed and admire them. As he is corrected by all, that is, the thoughts in his mind are exposed and displayed to everyone. Now, it is not similar to someone walking in and observing one individual speaking Persian and another speaking Syriac. Rather, it's like someone entering and hearing the secrets of his own mind, whether he enters with a deceitful and malevolent intention or genuinely, or that such an event has occurred involving him and another has been planned. This is much more profound and beneficial than the other scenario. Hence, even though he claims you are insane in regard to languages, he does not insist on this on his own account, but because of their judgment. "They will say that you are insane," he says, while here he refers to both the reality of the situation and the judgment of those who benefit from it. "For he is corrected by everyone," he says. "He is judged by everyone. And this is how the secrets of his heart become apparent, whereby he will fall on his face and worship God, confessing that indeed God is in your midst." Do you see that this does not allow for multiple interpretations? How in the first situation there could be doubt over what is happening, and occasionally a non-believer might attribute it to insanity, but here there will be none of that. Instead, he will be astonished and worship, first professing with his actions, followed by his words. Similarly, Nebuchadnezzar revered God, declaring, "Indeed, your God, it's he who reveals secrets, since you could disclose this secret." Do you see the power of prophecy and how it transformed that brutal individual, brought him into education, and led him to faith? Verse 26. "So what then, brothers? When you all come together, each one of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation. Let everything be done for edification." Do you see the foundation and principle of Christianity? How just as it is the craftsman's job to build, so it is the Christian's job to support their neighbors in all things. But since he had strongly criticized the gift, to avoid it seeming unnecessary, he did this primarily to curb their pride, he again compares it with other gifts, saying, one has a psalm, one has a teaching, one has a tongue. For in the past, they also used to create psalms and teach as a gift. Yet, he states, let everyone aim for one thing, the improvement of their neighbor. Let nothing be done aimlessly, for if you're not coming to build up your brother, why are you here at all? I do not value the differences in gifts. My primary concern and desire is to do everything for the purpose of building others up. In doing so, he who has the lesser gift may outperform him who has the greater, if this is not lacking. Yes, the gifts are given so each one might be built up. For if this doesn't happen, the gift will instead lead to the condemnation of the receiver. For what, tell me, is the use of prophesying? What is the use of raising the dead when no one benefits from it? But if this is the goal of the gifts, and it's possible to achieve it in another way without gifts, do not brag about your signs, nor lament if you lack the gifts. Verse 27, and if anyone speaks in a language, let it be by two, or at the most by three, and in turns, and let one person interpret. Verse 28, but if there is no interpreter, he should remain silent in the church, and should talk to himself and to God. What are you saying? Tell me. Having already discussed that the gift of speaking in tongues is unprofitable and superfluous if there's no interpreter, are you suggesting we continue to speak in tongues? He replies, I'm not commanding, nor am I prohibiting, similar to when he says, if any non-believers invite you to a feast and you want to go, it's not a law that compels you to go, just not preventing you. So is the same here. And let him speak to himself and to God. If they can't stand to be silent but are ambitious and arrogant, let them speak alone. The act of permitting this adequately checks them and makes them feel ashamed. A tactic he uses elsewhere when discussing marital relations and saying, but I say this because of your lack of self-control. But this wasn't his approach when discussing prophecy. So how did he go about it? With an authoritative tone and legislation, let the prophet speak, two or three. Nowhere here does he request an interpreter, nor does he silence the prophet as he did earlier, saying, if there's no interpreter, let him remain quiet, since in truth someone speaking in tongues alone is insufficient. So if anyone has both gifts, let them speak. But if they don't, but still want to speak, let them do so with the help of an interpreter. For the prophet is an interpreter, but of God, you are of man. But if there is no interpreter, let him remain quiet. For nothing should be done unnecessarily or out of ambition. Only let him speak to himself and to God. That means silently or quietly, at least if he wants to speak. For this doesn't sound like a law, but more like a way to shame them even more with his permission. Similar to how he says, but if anyone's hungry, let him eat at home. And seeming to give permission, but critiques them even more sharply. For you don't gather for the purpose, he says, of showing off your gifting, but to edify the listeners. Which he previously stated, let everything done be for edification. Let the prophet speak in twos or threes and let the others interpret. He has not added at most as he did regarding tongues, but how is this, one might ask? Because he implies that prophecy alone is not sufficient, especially if he leaves judgment to others. Well, indeed it is sufficient, and this is why he didn't silence the prophet, as he would with others when there is no interpreter. Nor did he state, as with the case of the interpreter, if there is no interpreter, let him remain silent. Or in the case of the prophet, if no one can discern, let him not prophesy. Instead, he simply ensured the listener, for satisfying the listener was his reason for saying this, so that no fortune-teller might intermix with them. For he warned them about this at the beginning, when he differentiating between fortune-telling and prophecy, and now he instructs them to discern and investigate the matter further, so that no satanic teacher might secretly infiltrate. But if a revelation is made to another who is sitting by, let the first one keep quiet. For you all can prophesy one by one, so that everyone may learn and everyone may be comforted. What does this spoken statement mean? If you're prophesying, he says, and while you're speaking, another person feels moved by their spirit, stop speaking from then on. This rule he mentioned in the case of speaking in tongues, he asks for again here, that it should be done in turn, but in a more sacred manner here. Yet he doesn't use the exact term, in turn, instead saying, if a revelation is made to another. Why would it be necessary for the first person to continue speaking when the second person is moved to prophesy? Should both speak? No, this would be disrespectful and create confusion. Should only the first person speak? This too wouldn't be appropriate. The purpose of the Spirit moving the second person while the first is speaking is for the second person also to offer some insight. So he comforted the one who had been silenced and said, "You all can prophesy one by one, so that everyone may learn and everyone may be comforted." Do you see how he again provides the reason for his actions? If he completely forbids the one who speaks in tongues to talk when there's no interpreter because of its unprofitability. It's also reasonable that he would limit prophecy if it doesn't have this quality, but only creates confusion, disturbance, and unseasonable uproar. And the spirits of the prophets are controlled by the prophets. Do you see how he earnestly and fearfully embarrassed him? So that the man might not argue or be defiant, he indicates that the gift itself was subject. For by spirit here, he refers to its actual function. But if the spirit is subject, you, its owner, have even less right to be argumentative. Then he indicates that this also pleases God, adding and saying, "For God is not a God of confusion, but of peace, as I teach in all the churches of the saints." Do you see how he uses so many reasons to bring him to silence and soothe him as he gives way to another, by one major point, that he is not silenced by this course of action? "For you all can prophesy," he says, "one by one." By a second, that this is even in line with the Spirit himself, for the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. In addition to these, that this is according to God's will. For God, he says, is not a God of confusion, but of peace. And by a fourth, that this practice is common everywhere in the world, and nothing unusual is being imposed on them. "For this," he says, "is what I teach in all the churches of the saints." What now could be more dreadful than these things? The church was truly a heaven back then, with the Spirit controlling everything and inspiring each of the leaders. But now, we only retain symbols of these gifts. We speak two or three at a time, taking turns, and when one of us stops speaking, another begins. However, these are just signs and reminders. Therefore, when we begin to speak, the people respond, "with your spirit," implying that they also used to speak not from their own wisdom, but from the inspiration of the Spirit. But this is not the case now. The current church resembles a woman who has declined from her previous flourishing days and now only possesses signs of her past prosperity. She presents the containers of her golden treasures but lacks the wealth itself. I do not mention this only in regard to gifts. It wouldn't be surprising if it were just about gifts, but it also pertains to life and virtue. The church used to be decorated with the presence of widows and the choir of virgins, but now it feels abandoned and only the markers remain. Indeed, there are still widows and virgins. However, they lack the virtues which women possessing such titles should display. A virgin's specialty should be caring solely for God's matters and serving Him without distraction. Likewise, the mark of a widow should not merely be the absence of a second marriage, but rather the other virtues such as charity to the poor, hospitality, constant prayers, and all the other things that Paul demanded from Timothy with great precision. You can observe married women among us behaving appropriately, but this is not the only requirement. Instead, they should display more of the attention and care to the needy through which the women of the past shined brightly. Unlike the majority of women nowadays, instead of gold, they used to wear the beautiful attire of almsgiving. But now, having abandoned this, they are adorned from head to toe with golden chains knitted from their sins. Should I mention another storehouse also stripped of its inherited glory? They all gathered together in the past and sang hymns together. We do this now too, but back then there was a single soul and a unified heart among everyone. But now, not in one single soul can we see that unity, rather there is great conflict everywhere. Peace, even now, to all, the one who leads the church prays for, entering, so to speak, into his Father's house. But of this peace the name is common, but its reality not found anywhere. Then houses were essentially churches, but now the church has become just another house, or even worse, for there is usually order in a house. The lady of the house sits in her chair with decorum, the young women work silently, and each servant has a specific duty. But here there is great chaos, and our gatherings might as well be at a wine merchant's. So hearty is the laughter, so loud the disruption. It's like being at the baths or the market with their noise and commotion. And these things only happen here, since elsewhere it's not even allowed to talk to your neighbor in church, even if you've just been reunited with a long-lost friend. But these interactions are kept outside the church, as they should be. For the church is not a barber's shop, a perfumer's boutique, or a merchant's warehouse, but it's a place for angels, a place for archangels, a palace for God, heaven itself. So just as if someone allowed a glimpse of heaven and invited you there, even if you saw your father or your brother, you wouldn't dare to talk. Likewise, here one should only utter spiritual phrases. For indeed, the things within the church are sacred. It's like heaven on earth. And if you don't believe, look at this table. Remember for whose sake it is set, and why. Consider who it is that is coming forth here. Tremble with awe even before the time. For so, when one sees only the throne of a king, he rises up in his heart, expecting the king's arrival. And you too. Thrill with awe even before that thrilling moment. Lift up yourself, and before you see the veils drawn aside and the choir of angels marching forth, ascend you to the very heaven. But the uninformed doesn't know these things. Well then, it's necessary to introduce other topics for his sake too, for we won't lack arguments capable of thoroughly inspiring him and causing him to rise above. You then, who do not know these things, when you hear the prophet saying, "Thus says the Lord, leave the earth, ascend also to heaven," consider who it is that speaks with you through him. But as it stands for a clown provoking laughter, or for a promiscuous, abandoned woman, such a large gathering of spectators is arranged, listening in complete silence to what is spoken, and this without anyone demanding silence. And there is no chaos, nor outcry, nor any slightest noise. But when God is speaking from heaven on topics so serious, we behave more shamelessly than dogs, and even to the prostitute women we show more respect than to God. Does it make your skin crawl to be told of these things? If not, then much rather let it crawl when you do them. What Paul said about those who disregarded the poor and feasted alone, "Don't you have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing?" I would like to say the same about those who cause disruptions and engage in conversations in this place. "Don't you have homes to play around in? Or do you despise the church of God and lead even those who would be modest and quiet astray? But it's delightful and enjoyable for you to chat with your friends. I'm not forbidding this, but it should be done at home, in the market, or at the baths. For the church is not a place for socializing, but for learning. But now it's no different from a marketplace. Nay, it's even, dare I say, akin to a theatre, given how scandalously the women who gather here attire themselves compared to those who are found there. As a result, we see that even here, many degenerates are enticed by them, and if anyone is planning or aiming to seduce a woman, there's likely no place that seems more fitting to him than the church, and if something is to be sold or bought, the church seems more handy than a market, for more chatter on such topics happens here than in the shops themselves. Or if anyone wants to divulge or hear any gossip, you'll find that it is more accessible here than outside in the public square. And if you want updates about political affairs, individual families, or military matters, skip the courthouse or the pharmacy, for here, those things are talked about with more accuracy. Our gatherings are anything but a church. Could it be that I have deeply affected you? I personally don't think so, because as long as you continue in the same behavior, how am I to know that you are moved by what has been said? Therefore, I must inevitably address the same issues again. Are these things then to be tolerated? Are these things to be suffered? We exhaust and preoccupy ourselves every day, so you may not leave without having learned something useful, and none of you leave at all improved, but rather more harmed. Yes, and you come together for judgment, having no longer any cover for your sin, and you push away the more modest, upsetting them with your foolishness on every side. But what does the crowd say? I don't hear what is being read, says one, nor do I understand the words that are spoken. This is because you're causing a commotion and confusion. This is because you're not coming with a respectful soul. What are you saying? I don't know what is being said. Well, for this very reason, you should pay attention. But if not even the uncertainty stimulates your soul, you'd likely neglect them even more if things were clear. Yes, this is exactly why not everything is clear, to prevent you from becoming complacent. Nor is it complex, to prevent you from giving up. And where that eunuch and foreigner didn't say any of these things, but was engrossed in important affairs and had a book in his hand reading during his journey. Should you, with an abundance of teachers and private readers, offer me your excuses and pretexts? Don't you know what is said? Then pray so you may learn. But surely it's impossible not to know everything. For many things are self-explanatory and clear. Furthermore, even if you are unaware of all, you still ought to remain quiet, so as not to disrupt those who are focused, that God, appreciating your silence and respect, may clarify the unclear things as well. But if you can't stay quiet, then leave, so as not to become a nuisance to others too. In truth, there should only be one voice in the church, just as there is only one body. Therefore, both the person who reads speaks out alone, the bishop himself is satisfied to sit in silence, and the person who sings, sings alone, and even if everyone responds, the voice is carried as if from one mouth, and the person who delivers a sermon does so alone. When there are many discussing various different topics, why do we bother you for no reason? Surely, unless you thought that we are merely bothering you for no apparent reason, you wouldn't discuss trivial matters in the middle of our conversation on such important issues. Therefore, not just in your actions, but in your very perception of things, there is significant distortion. And you lust after unnecessary things, leaving the truth in pursuit of various illusions and fantasies. Aren't all tangible things illusions and fantasies, or even worse than illusions? For even before they materialize, they fade away, and before they are gone, the trouble they bring outweighs the pleasure. Let a person accumulate and bury vast wealth in this earth, yet when the night is over he will depart bare, which is unsurprising, because even those who are rich only in their dreams wake up empty-handed from their slumber, having none of what they seem to possess in their sleep. So it is with the greed-driven, or rather not so, but in a far worse state. For the one who dreams of being rich not only doesn't have the money he thought he had, but also wakes up with no other harm caused by this illusion. But this greed-driven man is both stripped of his wealth and must also leave, burdened with the sins that arise from it. His wealth was merely imagined, but the evils resulting from his wealth are not mere fantasies, but the reality of things. His pleasure was in dreams, but the punishment following his pleasure is no longer a dream, but a lived reality. Even before that punishment, even here, he suffers a severe penalty, eroding himself with countless sorrows, anxieties, self-blame, defamation, conflicts, and disturbances in the very process of amassing his wealth. Therefore, in order for us to be delivered from both dreams and evils that aren't in dreams, let's opt for almsgiving instead of covetousness, mercy to mankind instead of robbery. By doing this, we shall attain both present and future blessings through the grace and mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ, who with the Father and the Holy Ghost is worthy of glory, power, honor, now and forever, and for a world without end. Amen.